Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told, and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. This is Fanny Crawford, your storytelling co-host, and
Stash Siolkowski,
our other storytelling co-host. And we're glad you've joined us today. It is Monday, sort of, April 22nd, and our theme today is Scary Spaces. Is that right, Stash?
Well, I had places.
Places. Scary
spaces work.
Places.
Because a place is a space. Or space is a place. All that stuff. And the music you heard at the beginning of this broadcast is from Andy Offit Irwin, who is a great musician, symphonic whistler, very entertaining storyteller, one of the funniest people I've ever met. And is a good friend to us because he lets us use his original song to bring in the show.
Well, even before that, he was a good friend to us. But now he's know for sure that...
Are you intimating that I only like him because he let us use a song?
I don't intimate. I'm not sure I even know what that means.
I saw it on a crossword puzzle and it looked pretty interesting. So
well... Thank you, Andy Offit Irwin. We do appreciate having that music.
That's scary. You looked at me and said, thank you, Andy Offit Irwin.
No,
you were imagining.
I do know the difference.
Yeah, about a foot and 3 inches.
Stash, talk about Speak Story Series, would you?
Speak Story Series.
Yes.
Which is going gangbusters this year. And... let's see, Speak Story Series. We had a wonderful presentation from Michael and Carrie Klein on their Tuesday performance this month, April the 9th, and one of the largest crowds we've ever had. In fact, it might have been the largest attendance. And they did a wonderful show, singing storytellers. And they're Appalachian storytellers. They also did a great program called Revelations that I was proud to be a part of. There were 12 of us on stage who were doing a reader's theater. And it was a wonderful experience. But now, coming up next, is Carolina Quiroga Stultz. And I'm really looking forward to this program, because it will be completely different than Appalachian. And there are lots of exciting things happening. We have a great lineup of storytellers coming for the rest of the year. And lots of interesting people. And I have forgotten my paper for some reason. I cleaned out my clipboard this morning, and I must have left my list at home of the people who are performing. But we'll catch up with that.
Okay. Well, I think I'm ready to tell a story. If together, collectively, we are ready for that.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. Our theme today is scary places, scary spaces. And... I want to talk about cribs where babies sleep. Cribs where I slept as a baby. So I'm going to transport back to that time. There is a big black ant on the floor in the doorway of my bedroom, just visible to me from my crib. Behind that ant is another one. Behind that one are two more, and two more after that, and behind them, three and three more, and then a line of four and four more coming close behind, and then a longer line and many, many more behind them. I am 3 years old. I can only count to 20, but I can see lots more than that. The ants are walking slower than I could walk, but fast for ants, inexorably closer and closer to my crib. It's mostly dark in my room, but there is enough light from the hallway for me to watch their progress across the floor. My face is pressed against the side slats of my crib for a better view of these ants. By the time they reach the legs of my crib, there are many, many, many more of them, and they are tenacious, although I don't know that word, in their quest to get into my bed. I can feel tears running down my face. There's nowhere for me to go. I'm in my crib. The house is mostly dark. My parents are asleep. There's no one to save me. The ants begin their slow and steady climb up the legs and onto the side rails of my crib. I watch them coming closer, closer toward me. My face and hair are wet now. I'm sweating, and my pajamas are damp around my neck and down the front from my tears. The ants keep coming over the top rail, down the upright slats, onto the mattress, walking single file across my favorite plaid blanket. So many ants. The long line of them comes closer and closer to my face. Ba-pum, ba-pum. I can feel my heart pounding in my chest. The ants go marching one by one, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching one by one, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching one by one with a clash of sabers and rattle of drums. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. When I was 3 years old, I had that recurring dream or nightmare of watching a long line of ants crawling along the rails of my crib. I would watch them, eyes wide as they came within inches of my face. I always woke up about this point in the dream, sometimes screaming. I really did not want to tell my mother about this dream, because I knew it was just a dream. I knew it wasn't real. And even at 3 years old, I didn't want to hear my mom tell me what I already knew. I remember screaming myself awake at least once, and my mother coming into the room and turning on the light. I don't think I told her what the dream was about, but she dried my tears, covered me up, and patted my back till I fell asleep. Eventually, I learned to wrest some control from those terrifying ants. I learned to wake myself up and put myself back to sleep. But I was always afraid those ants would come again. The ants go marching two by two, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching two by two, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching two by two. They're not afraid of me and you. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. My mother knew where that dream came from. Many years later, when I was maybe 12, I asked her why I would have been dreaming about ants when I was so little. Well, she knew exactly what I was talking about. She said one day about that time, I was supposed to spend the day with another family while my parents were away for the day. But there was a big traffic jam on the way home. Mom and Dad were 5 or 10 minutes late getting back. And this was way before cell phones and public phone booths were not on every corner. Besides, they were in a big traffic snarl up trying to figure out the fastest route home. But the family that I spent the day with were always trying to get some were also needed to get somewhere for the evening, and they left me on the front steps of our apartment building. They did tell our next door neighbor what they were doing. And bless her heart, that old lady tried to get me to come inside her house, but I wouldn't. The neighbor brought out candy and lemonade and set them on the step for me. The car drove away and left me all alone on the steps. I sat there for what seemed a long, long time. And somehow in the confusion and my panic, some of the lemonade spilled and I got some of the sticky candy and lemonade on my hands and clothes. I wouldn't eat or drink anything. Just sat there with my nose running and my face sticky with tears. And the old lady neighbor went back into her house and I was all alone. Ants began to climb the steps, attracted by all that sugar. I watched the ants coming, first just one and then two and then three and finally a long line of them marching to the spilled lemonade and then into the glass and over the candy and eventually climbing right over my shoes and then on my sticky hands. I tried to shake them off my hands, but I couldn't get them off. And then they were all over my arms, climbing all over me, and I couldn't make them stop. Closer and closer to my face. And by the time my parents arrived to rescue me, I was hysterical. The ants go marching 10 by 10. Ba-boom. Ba-boom. The ants go marching 10 by 10. Ba-boom. Ba-boom. The ants go marching 10 by 10. We'll all be dead and skeletons then. And none of us left at the bitter end when the ants go marching home.
Now I'm scared. I do not like crawly things.
Ants are not scary to me anymore, but no. I do remember my crib being a scary place for a while.
That's terrible.
I did recover.
Are you sure?
Why, do you have any ants?
No. No. I just, creepy crawly things. I grew up in Baltimore.
They have ants in Baltimore.
We had water bugs.
Oh, yes. Big, big black and brown water bugs.
Yes. And go downstairs and at night and turn on the kitchen light and you could watch the rodeo. That's what my father called it. So anyway, we were always, I just have always hated those kinds of invaders. And I don't like killing things, but I will put out traps and stuff like that for them. Make them go away. Well, you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, coming to you from Bolivar, West Virginia, with co-host Stasiolkowski. And
who?
Stasiolkowski, who's just getting over his fear of the ants. And
Fanny Crawford, your other co-host.
Yes. Okay, so my story for a scary place is about the house I lived in Baltimore from 2 months after I was born until the day I went into the Army, 2 months before my 18th birthday. My parents actually were renting a house at 1806 Bank Street. And then when I was born in August of 1941, they then purchased the house at 1804. And so we moved into that house. And moving into that house had a bit of scare to it. I don't remember it because I was only 2 months old. But my brother, who's 3 years older than I, and my sister, who is 12 years older than I am, and my other brother, who is 9 years older, each one of them told me about the day of the move. My father had been injured on the job, and he had to be placed on a backboard, and two of his brothers carried him out the side door of 1806 and lifted him high enough in the air that they could get him across the fence. And a couple of neighbors, men, were on the other side of the fence, and they held on to the backboard while my uncles, Uncle Joel and Uncle Frankie, ran around the gate, came in, and then carried my dad into the house at 1804 and up the stairs to the bedroom where he spent some time because of his injury. That was the beginning, and that happened on October 31st, 1941. The house was really nice, and it was narrow, 14 feet wide. It was kind of like a trailer, except that it was three stories. And one of the things that's always puzzled me, and I never asked about it when I was young enough to know that, get the answer, because too many of the people who lived in that house are gone. In fact, the only two people who were around the day that we moved in are my brother, Tony, and myself. The rest of the family members are all gone. But there were nine people who lived in that house. My mom and dad, me, Tony, Paul, and Marcella. And then my mother's younger sister, my Aunt Bertha, and her two daughters, Jeannie and Bernice. Now, it was a three-story house, and there were two bedrooms on the third floor. There were two bedrooms on the second floor. My aunt and her two daughters lived in the front of the second floor, where there was a bedroom and a kitchen. My parents had a bedroom in the back of the house, which was like 8 feet from Aunt Bertha's kitchen. So those five people slept on the second floor. I have never been able to figure out, and I didn't think to ask when I was younger, where my sister and my two brothers and myself, where we slept, what the arrangement was. Recently, my brother Tony told me that my sister, being the oldest and a girl, had the front bedroom. And that meant that Paul and Tony and me, we shared the back bedroom, which was really small. And I do not remember ever knowing that. I have no pictures in my mind of me and my two brothers sharing that bedroom. The pictures in my mind about that bedroom are that I hated it. I was glad once I got into the Army and could sleep in a bunk in a room full of other men, or even sometimes when we were on maneuvers or something, sleep in a tent. I was always comfortable and slept really well. I never slept well in the bedroom that I used for 18 years. Nobody in my family could ever figure out why it bothered me so much that I had to go to bed first. I was the baby. In the corner of this, my bedroom, which had a slanted roof. We were on a third floor, so the front bedroom had a sloped roof, and the back bedroom had a sloped roof. So if you went to the windows in either one of those bedrooms, you had to bend down quite a bit because the top of the window was only 3 feet off the floor. So a normal-sized human being, even a normal-sized eight-year-old, would bump their head on the ceiling. In the back bedroom, which was mine, there was a closet in the corner. It was used for storage. I never, ever found out what was in the back of that closet because I never had the guts, the courage, the strength to open that closet door and to do more than hang something inside on the closet door. Because when I looked into that closet, which there was no light there, all I saw were dark things. And I began to believe that something lived in the back of that closet. That was as a teenager. Years and years and years later, when I was a bachelor for a while in my life, after my first marriage ended, I moved into that house with my sister and brother-in-law. My parents were deceased, and my brothers were gone. Off went their life. And I had called my sister and asked if I could come and stay there. And she said yes, and asked if I would like them to clean up the third floor, which they were using for storage, and I said, no, thank you. She couldn't believe that I would be willing to sleep someplace else, since I had spent a great deal of my life in that room. But I told her I didn't want anything to do with that room, and I wasn't exactly sure why. Just when I first moved there, two of my nieces, my sister's daughters, had cleaned up the back bedroom on the second floor for me, where my parents had used that as a bedroom. And shortly after being there with my sister and her husband, I took a walk up to the third floor and opened the door to see what it felt like to be in that room. I took two steps into the room, turned around, left, and closed the door. And my sister and her husband had a great deal of fun with me that night when I told them about it, and I couldn't explain it. Well, at this time in my life, I was in my mid-40s, and I had some issues about when my mother died, and I came home the day she was, after she died, and she was in the coffin. And she and I had had a couple of terrible arguments the last time we were in the same place together. And that preyed on my mind. I couldn't get it out of my mind. And so I went to a counselor. Actually, he was a psychologist. And he asked me lots of things about growing up. I had a lot of issues with my mother because she wanted me to be a priest. And he talked to me quite a bit about my childhood. And when I revealed my fear of this room that I had spent all my young years in, he suggested that maybe he should hypnotize me and take me back. A regression therapy, he called it. And that he would try to get to the root of it and see if there wasn't a some instant that we could work on. However, I'm easily hypnotized. I found that out by having a guest speaker in my classroom. And the psychologist did hypnotize me, took me back to as young an age as he could. And these are his words. When he woke me up, I stopped you just about at the age of 3 because whatever was happening to you in that bedroom was too much. And I didn't think I should have you go there. I thought it was kind of a little bit weird. I was 47 years old at the time. Anyway, moved probably 10 years after that. I still had not resolved a lot of my issues about my faith, my Catholic faith and things like that, which had taught me since the time I was old enough to understand anything at all that I was going to burn in hell for the rest of my life and all eternity and all this other stuff. So I went for another counselor, and she was wonderful, a psychiatrist who spent almost a year with me. And in our discussions, she came to the conclusion that something had happened to me as a young child, and that the fear of that bedroom had something that had imprinted itself on my life, and I had lots of things that bothered me inwardly. People outside never knew it. I mean, I had a 40-year career in a classroom. No one's ever suspected me of having a mental issue or something like that. That might not be true. But anyway, this woman, a PhD, a doctor, also used regression therapy with me. And she hypnotized me. The next thing I knew, she was waking me up. I was sitting in the chair, and she was just staring at me. And she told me, "I don't think we should do this again. I think maybe we should just let it go. You're doing well with lots of other things, but there is something that you are so terrified of that I didn't think it would be wise to continue." That's the last person I've gone to. And it was 24, 23 years ago. And I've stopped thinking about it. But the most horrible thing I could think anybody would do to me now would be to bind me in some way and put me in that bedroom, close the door, turn out all the lights, and leave me there, because I think I would probably die of fright.
And on that note...
that's the scariest place I've ever been in my whole life.
Wow.
Spent almost 18 years in that room. Aha! And Fanny's looking at me and saying to herself, so now I know. And I'm riding in the car alone with this guy.
No, I want to know if you're ever at all curious to... Obviously not.
Well, I was curious for a long time. I was very curious, but in talking to this psychiatrist, she convinced me that she didn't see any benefit to possibly reliving an event that had caused me such a block. And that it apparently hadn't kept me from having a career and doing lots of things. But there was something about my first couple of years that she didn't think it would be healthy to go any further. And I believe her, because that's been quite a few years. And I have a curiosity about it, but I had great faith in this doctor. And I don't want to know if something terrible happened in that room.
Fair enough.
Yeah. My imagination is good enough.
Well, I'm never going to hypnotize you. I can tell you that.
That's good.
My, oh, my, oh, my.
And you are listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. Coming to you from Bolivar, West Virginia, with your co-host
Fanny Crawford
and Stasz Ziolkowski.
Okay, I may recover soon from that story, but while that's happening, I would like to talk about stories in the round, because I did bring my schedule with me, and actually, I think I have a speak story schedule someplace here, which I may find while you tell your next story. But Stories in the Round was just last night for April, and you were there, Stasz, as well as 40 other people.
That was wonderful. 42.
42 others? Okay.
I think.
I may have miscounted. Janice Curtis Green was our storyteller. from Baltimore, Maryland, and she told us a little bit about her personal life and that she's the current president of the National Association of Black Storytellers, and she's on Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland's Black History Commission. Was that right? Do I have the title right?
Yes.
Something close to that. And a little bit about her other community activities. But that just lasted about 45 seconds, that little bit. And then she wowed us with some wonderful, wonderful stories.
Absolutely wonderful.
Do you want to say anything about that, or should I just go on?
It was one of the best performances I've ever seen.
Wow.
I've seen lots and lots of storytellers, and she had me from the second she began to speak all the way through her entire performance.
She was dynamic.
She was
great stories.
Really dynamic, and kept it going, and her timing and her language was just wonderful.
I loved every minute of it. Right. I had only heard her tell a very short story at NABS, at the conference in North Carolina this year, National Association of Black Storytellers. So watching her do a full hour set and then answer questions for another 15 minutes or so.
I've done a lot of workshops with top storytellers, and I think I would love to spend a couple of hours with her and have her beat some things out of me or into me, because her techniques were so wonderful.
Wow.
And her physical, her body language.
Yeah, she's a very physical teller.
And her, I was so impressed with her timing.
Mm-hmm.
There is always some place in a story where a pause is really effective, and her stories weren't just off the cuff.
Oh no,
those stories were.
Well, she had so many strategies for engagement, so many ways to keep the audience riveted. It was really stunning.
She got us to join in and sing along with her. And one of the few times, I think, in storytellers who did not, she did not like go over and over and over and over something with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
She did it one time and said, now you just do this.
And we did.
And in no time at all, we were part of the song and we knew our part.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it wasn't just saying a couple words. It was, we had like four lines.
Yeah, we did.
And
I was pretty stunned by that.
I thought it was wonderful.
Well, if you weren't there, listeners, you're just out of luck for that particular story set, although she is coming back to Hagerstown to perform at the Washington County Museum of Fine Arts on July 21st. And so we'll tell you more about that when we get close. But we were saying, Stosh was saying that Janice Curtis Green, who was with us last night at Stories in the Round, is a very physical teller, somebody who really engages her whole self in her performance. And we have another very physical teller coming, but just by coincidence, next month on May 27th, Elaine Murray will be our teller for Stories in the Round at 13245 Searfoss Pike, that's Unitarian Universalist Church, out on Salem Avenue Extended, becomes Searfoss Pike, if you know Hagerstown. And Elaine Murray is a mime and a physical storyteller. She trained with some well-known, well, not that well-known to me, because I can't remember their names right this minute. I don't have it in front of me.
And she's the lady we went to the coffee shop to see.
That's right, at the Black Dog.
Black Dog Coffee.
Yeah. Right. And I'm really looking forward to that. I've been trying to get her here since we went to hear her 2 years ago.
Wow.
And now we finally have her lassoed. She's coming all the way from Arizona. And she has some other gigs on the East Coast, I believe. But she will be with us in Hagerstown on May 27th, 7 p.m. And if you want more information either about the series or about that particular event, you can reach me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or via email at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. June 24th is Noah Baum, who will be telling The Land Twice Promised. July 22nd, Donald Davis. August 19th, Andy Offit Irwin. September 23rd, Jim May. October 28th, Dovey Thomason. Coming back to Stories in the Round. November 25th, Mitch Capel makes his Hagerstown debut. Fabulous storyteller, very funny guy. And December 23rd, I think Fanny Crawford will be performing.
Yes, that's true.
Did you hear that rumor?
I heard that rumor.
Okay.
Fanny told me that herself.
That's the lineup. 301-730-1638 if you want more information about any of those. Usually fourth Mondays of the month, but if you were following us on the calendar, you will note that there were two sessions that will not be on the fourth Thursday, Monday. So you'll have to check your calendar.
Okay.
You have another story for us?
Well, I do.
Okay.
Really?
Take it away.
All right. Well, this is in a completely different part of the world.
Well, that's good. We like to travel.
Yes. In Germany. I went into the United States Army at the age of 17, 1 month, almost 2 months before, no, 1 month before my 18th birthday. Spent my first year in the Army going through basic training in South Carolina, Columbia, and also going to Texas, to El Paso, Texas, to a place called Fort Bliss. Oh boy, was that a name that you... Oh. Anyway, it was lots of sand and lots of heat and almost no rain. In fact, the newspaper that in El Paso, Texas, had a box on the front page, and it would say, "Today is the 243rd day with no precipitation," and on and on and on. Anyway, in the summer of 1960, I got orders that I was going to be going to Germany. And I did. I went to Germany, and our base in Germany, where we stayed and slept, was in barracks that the German army had used during the Second World War. Marble floors, stone walls. And the place where we worked was on a small mountaintop. I was in a radar section. We were on the lookout for planes. And there was another section to our company, which was down in the valley, and that was where the missiles were. They were called the launcher area. So we were in the radar, they were in the launcher area. And on top of that mountain, if we could have gotten well above it in the air and looked down, there was a road through the woods that climbed the mountain, and when it got to the top, the area would look like an outline of a skull. There was a gate. It was just a wooden barrier that was hooked on one side, and we could open and close, but it stayed closed all the time unless we were letting someone in or out. And a thin road bordered by some bushes and things, about 100 yards, and then the area was surrounded, a kind of a big round oval. And in that oval area, which covered quite a bit of distance, I would say maybe close to a half mile, there were two operational Nike Ajax radar systems. We were Company B, the other one was Company A, and they were farther along. Well, our job, as I said, was to protect Landstuhl Hospital and Air Base. And there was no war at the time, and so it was pretty routine. One day, when I was ready to go on gate duty, which when we were on duty on the mountain, each of us on the crew would do a two-hour duty at the gate. And not everybody on the crew did that. There were usually six of us because we worked 24 hours on, 24 hours off. So the six of us would take two-hour shifts, and we usually had two of those in the 24 hours. I was getting ready to go on to the duty when there was a call from the guard shack at the gate, and a friend of mine by the name of John was on duty, and he called up to the radar center and said, "I need someone down here as quick as possible." And so the sergeant on duty sent me about 15 minutes early. I wasn't too thrilled about that because, you know, guarding the gate was a really boring job. But I hustled down to the gatehouse, and standing just outside the guard shack, which is only big enough for a person to stand inside and spread their elbows. If you stuck your arms out to both sides, you would be touching the walls. It was very small. And there was a German civilian talking to Johnny. And Johnny had been in Germany longer than I had. I never learned to speak German, but he had picked up a lot of German. And he said, "This man wants me to go with him down through the woods. There is another road, and there's a car parked down there. He was telling me that there's somebody in the car." Well, there was not supposed to be anybody on that mountain, but we did get some German civilians who would go wildflower picking or take a stroll with their girlfriend or something. It was very nice scenery. So I took over Johnny's position, and he went with the German man. And in just a few minutes, he came back. We called up to the guard shack, and the officer on duty and one of the sergeants and a couple of other men came down. What Johnny had seen was a United States Army sergeant sitting in the front seat of a car behind the driver's wheel with his head blown off. And it was very disturbing to him. We had to actually go, and I was posted to guard that car with another man while the officer in charge made arrangements for headquarters to send somebody out, because they were going to have to tow that car and they were going to have to deal with the body. It was daylight when all of this took place, and so it was just a matter of being a soldier on duty and doing what you're supposed to do. The other man that guarded the car with me until the headquarters people showed up and actually got an ambulance and they came to take the body away. If I have my memory correct, I know I only glanced once in that car, and I don't think the other man looked in it any more than once. In fact, we stood with our backs to the car on duty. It was a grisly sight. It's one thing for young men to go in the service and talk about being soldiers and all this blah, 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 but if you've never been in combat and you haven't had to shoot at anyone or be shot at, it really isn't a game. And so when you see something like that, it all of a sudden brings to light that, hey, you know, I'm in a place where it might be scary. And the next time I was on duty at the mountain, just 2 days later, and on guard duty at that shack, I could not take my eyes off that part of the woods. I wasn't thinking about the road that led up to us, which was just a dirt road, or anyone else, all I could think of was that there had been a dead guy about 30 yards away from our guard shack. And over a period of time, it turned out that he hadn't, according to the investigation, he had not killed himself. At first, they thought he had put a gun to his right temple and killed himself. It turned out he was left-handed, and the gun had no prints on it that they could identify, but the prints that were on it were not the sergeant's. That made guard duty a lot more interesting, because then the older guys didn't pay much attention to it, at least in front of us. But I was only 19 when I got to Germany, and that was a big impact on me, because I'd never had to spend time any place where there was a dead person that may have been rendered dead by being murdered. And so that guard shack is the second scariest place I ever spent time. I was glad when my duty was over and I could get away from it.
Whoa, you're just full of sunshine and light today, Stosh. Scary, scary, scary places.
And the interesting thing was the older soldiers, the sergeants and the two of the officers who had seen duty in Korea, they didn't really make fun of us, the younger guys, but they emphasized to us how lucky we were that there wasn't anybody shooting at us constantly, and that we didn't have to shoot people.
You only need somebody to shoot at you once.
Right, but, you know, they kind of put it in perspective, but it still didn't make it comfortable to be there at 2 in the morning in the dark.
And, sure.
You know, there was no light on the road. So you were in a guard shack alone, and we were not allowed to have a light in a guard shack because some guys had been reading and fell asleep. So they took away the light. They took away the stove because people had fallen asleep on guard duty.
Boy.
So scary, dark, and cold. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, coming to you from Bolivar, West Virginia. This is Stosh Ziolkowski, your co-host, and
Fanny Crawford.
Yes. And Fanny's getting ready to tell a story.
I think so. I think what I'm going to do is do a little poem that's about a scary place.
Right. And by the way, before you begin, I heard you do the ant thing before.
Yeah, you did. Several times, I think.
I didn't recall it when you first began, and then when you did the little singing part, I thought, I remember that.
Yeah, so that's just a piece of the longer dance piece that you heard.
Right.
Well, you heard it once at a festival, and I think I did it on the air here once a long time ago. Okay, here's a poem by Mark Halliday, poet Mark Halliday. It's called Bad People. Uh-oh. And I think this fits the theme of scary places, scary spaces. Bad People, Mark Halliday. The guys who drank quarts of Busch last night here by the backstop of this baseball diamond had names given them by their mothers and fathers, Jack and Kenny, let us say. Jack might be a skinny guy in a black fake leather jacket. He's 25. His gray pants are too loose on his hips. His jaws always have these little black extra hairs. His mother won't talk to him on the phone. She lives on French fries and ketchup, and he hasn't been able to send her any cash in the last 2 years, ever since he lost his job unloading produce trucks at Pathmark. Jack's father disappeared when he was 10. No big deal, Jack says. He was a bastard anyway. He used to flatten beer cans on top of my head. Kenny offers a laugh noise. He's heard all that before. Kenny's 48, a flabby man with reddened skin. He's employed at the Italian market, selling fish just 4 hours a day, but his shirts hold the smell. His female companion, Dina, left him a note last month. You owe me $12 chocolate, $31 wine, $55 cable TV, plus donuts. I've had it. Take lamp and mirror, they're mine. Kenny hasn't seen her since. He hangs with Jack because Jack talks loud, as if the world of cops and people with full-time jobs could be kept at bay by talking loud. I'm talking gently and imaginatively here, as if the world of bums and jerks could be kept far off. Jack and Kenny, or two other guys, dark to me with wounds oozing, in Philadelphia, ways less ready to narrate. Last night at midnight, they got cheesesteaks at Casaloni's and bought four quarts at the Fireside Tavern and wandered into this park. After one quart of Bush, Jack said he was Lenny Dykstra and found a stick for his bat. Pitch to me, asshole, he said. So Kenny went to the mound and pitched his bottle for want of anything better, and Jack swung in the dark and missed. Kenny's bottle smashed on home plate, and Jack heard in the sound the absurdity of all his desiring since seventh grade. Absurdity of a skinny guy who blew everything since seventh, when he hit home runs and chased Joni Rundle around the gym. So Jack took his own empty bottle and smashed it down amid the brown shards of Kenny's bottle. And then they leaned on the backstop to drink the other two quarts, and they both grew glum and silent. And when they smashed these bottles, it was like, what else would they do? Next morning, Nikki and I come to the park with a rubber ball and a miniature bat. Nikki is not quite three, but he knows the names of all the Phillies starters, and he knows the area around home plate is not supposed to be covered with jagged pieces of brown glass. Like a good dad, I warn him not to touch it, and we decide to establish a new home plate closer to the mound. There's no trash can handy. Who put that glass there? Nikki wants to know. And to make a long story short, I say, bad people. Nikki says, bad? How come? That's Mark Halliday's poem, Bad People, from his collection called Self Wolf. Copyright 1999, Mark Halliday. That's a Philadelphia poem, but it was published by the University of Chicago Press. I like that poem.
Yeah.
It's a little bit scary. I grew up in Philadelphia. Right. You know.
A little bit scary. I was thinking of another scary place, but you shocked me with that.
Tell me about another scary space, place, Stash.
Okay. This is an Army story also. And I'm sure it's not original by a long shot. At first, I thought they'd probably do this every time they have a group of recruits go through basic training. But I went in basic training in 1959. I'm sure some military things are much different. However, I have watched some YouTube things about basic training in 2018, and that. Some of the behavior there hasn't changed at all from the drill sergeants and that. However, on a Saturday, we worked in basic training early Monday morning until noon at Saturday. once we got through the first 3 weeks. First 3 weeks, we worked 6 days a week, full days. But we really looked forward to that noon deadline on Saturday, because then the sergeants disappeared, and as long as we kept our place clean, our barracks clean, and our uniforms clean and in order, we pretty much had the day off, and Sunday was off also. We still had, some of us had duty. There was always kitchen duty and things like that, and guard duties. But basically, we could recoup from the week of, which was very difficult work, in at least as far as I was concerned, for 17, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. There was no one in my basic company that was older than the age of 20, except for the sergeants. We were all recruits, and many of us were just 17 and 18. Well, on this particular Saturday, we were going to be addressed by the commander of the fort, Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And we were gathered in an auditorium. There were probably at least 1,000 young men, all in the same basic training cycle. And we were being given a talk to by the commander of the fort. It was really boring. I can't even remember what the purpose of the talk was. But it was kind of like a rah-rah talk to tell us what good citizens we were for serving our country and everything, and that he was proud of how we were making progress to becoming soldiers, possibly. And when a man came down the aisle from the back, saluted to the officers that were on the stage and listening to the commander, and handed him a telegraph. And the commander looked at it, called us to attention, and read the telegraph. And I don't remember the exact words, but the gist of it was that, in military terms, that 0900 on that day, an invasion had taken place in America, that Russian troops had invaded New England and parts of Canada, and that we were about to go to war with Russia. The commander dismissed us to our company commanders. We were marched back to our barracks. I think the only sounds I remember were our boots on the ground, nothing else. We were gone to our barracks, were put into, got full field gear, all of our equipment, issued M1 rifles, which nowadays most people never heard of. We were using rifles that were from the Second World War in 1959. It was just a few years later that they changed to some of the more modern ones. And we were put into formation and marched to the front, towards the front gate of Fort Jackson, where many more than 1,000 men were in line in combat gear with fully loaded weapons. And there the commander of the fort addressed us again and thanked us for being so good at doing what we had learned in basic training. It had been a drill. And there are lots of things that were said about that day, but I can remember from the moment he opened that telegraph until he said it had been a drill, I was pretty much terrified, because I thought we were really going to be at war.
It seems an appropriate response. Whoa, yes. Quite a story.
Even all the tough guys.
Yeah.
Were, in fact, some of the guys we regarded as the toughest in our outfit were very shaken. You know.
Good.
I know I didn't want any parts of being in a war.
I'm going to remind our listeners at this point that you can listen to many, many, many Enlightened Radio, Enlightened Storytelling, our programs at our podcast site at talltales.enlightenradio.org. And there's at least 3 years of programs there for your listening enjoyment. But it's time for us to sign off.
Okay, and I will sign us off. So this is Stasi Okowski
and Fanny Crawford,
your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, an independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia, closing out this week's show. The Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Be sure to share your stories, collect stories, tell the stories to children, and listen to the stories from the older people in your family. Thanks for listening.